I will turn it over to the Groundfish Chair, Mr. Stockwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom and Annie have been extremely busy since we've last all met, and I'd like to thank them both, as well as Chad Demarest, for doing all the analysis and pulling together framework and time for today's meeting. I understand Chad worked over the weekend. There are a large number of documents behind tab 3, but I want to highlight for today's discussion two in particular, the draft framework 47 document and the framework 47 decision document. Since the last council meeting, aside from the sector workshop in Portland, the PDT's met twice, the committee's met twice, and the groundfish advisors and recreational advisory panel have each met. Tom's got a short presentation summarizing the proposed measures in Framework 47. And following any questions, I have about 20 committee motions, including, and this includes some motions that will defer measures to another action. So in speaking with the chair and with Tom, we're going to break Framework 47 into three components. And Rip, when we begin, we'll clarify the commenting process so everyone's crystal clear. Additionally, there are several other committee motions under other business, including recommendations for the recreational fishery AMs. Dr. Pierce will be providing a report, and I believe there's an emergency ground Gulf of Maine winter flounder motion that's going to be coming before us. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Tom, to kick things off. Thank you.
Good afternoon. As Terry pointed out, there's a few documents you may want to look at. I'm going to give a short presentation. You should also have a decision document. And then, of course, you've got the Framework 47 document. And just to be clear, there's a piece of the Framework 47 document that I delivered yesterday, which is an errata and additions, changing some of the economic impact analysis or adding some that was not in the framework document originally mailed to you. Give me a second here. Framework 47 measures are really grouped into a couple broad themes. First, we are updating the status determination criteria, rebuilding schedules, and specifications. We slipped into this section of the document some changes to the administration of the scallop sub-ACLs. A lot of the elements in this particular section of the document are relatively straightforward. I wouldn't expect a whole lot of discussion about them. And then the second is we're changing some fishery measures. When we initially started this section, we thought there was a chance there might be some recreational fishing measures in there. But in the reality, with the exception perhaps of one of the accountability measures, which is modified, there really are not any changes, not much to do with the recreational fishery. Most of the measures in this second section resulted from the need to address the accountability measures for what I would call the low or no possession stocks. The windowpane flounder stocks, ocean pout, halibut, wolffish, southern New England, mid-Atlantic winter flounder. But in addition, in this section, we also address some of the scallop ACL AM issues that have come up over the last year as well. So those are combined in here. As I already mentioned, many of these measures are relatively straightforward. I'm only going to give a quick overview from them as the motions come up. But as far as the presentation goes, I'm only going to go over some of the less easily understood measures up front. And so with that introduction, I'm going to put on my boutonniere and go to the dance, if I can get this to change here. So one of the things we're going to do in this action is we're going to revisit once again for about, I think, the third year in a row, the Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder Rebuilding Strategy. According to the track assessment that was completed this past summer, the stock cannot rebuild by 2016 in the absence of all fishing, which is our current rebuilding strategy. We are allowed to extend the rebuilding period beyond beyond 10 years because of recent changes to the law. You've all heard us talk before about the International Fishery Agreement Clarification Act. So in this option, we're continuing two options for alternatives to no action. The first, sub-option A, the rebuilding period length is how long we currently estimate it would take to rebuild at the default control rule. This is 2023 if you take into account the retrospective pattern observed in the 2011 assessment. And then sub-option B is we actually developed it using two different criteria that give us the same answer, which is how long it would take to rebuild at either the maximum F that will achieve our rebuilding target or roughly an average annual growth rate of 10%. And that ends in 2032 with a median probability, once again, if you take into account the retrospective pattern. Now, the committee talked about a bunch of other alternatives which didn't make it into the document. They're all plotted on this chart. I think the important thing to note is that when you get out towards the end of the rebuilding period, it gets very flat. And so, you know, if you're looking at probability of success, I think at 2028 it's like 48% probability, and it takes you another 2 or 3 years to creep up to the 50%. But the rebuilding strategies here are very flat as we go forward. Sub-option B, which is the committee's recommendation, returns marginally higher net yellowtail flounder revenues over the period of about a difference is about $11 million or about 5% over the terms of the rebuilding period. Sorry, I keep missing that. We're also going to adopt the U.S.-Canada tax. Just to be clear, at our last meeting, you approved the Eastern Georges Cod and Haddock tax. You sent the TMGC back to talk about Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder. They did meet. They agreed on a 1,250 metric ton, which was the ABC recommended by the SSC, and that's what's now in the option that would adopt the U.S.-Canada tax. We've got some proposals in this section that would revise how the scallop ACLs would be administered. The idea of the two options to no action is they are not mutually exclusive. You could vote for both of them. They were actually designed to work in tandem to address some concerns of the groundfish fishery and the scallop fishery together. So option two would say that we only trigger a scallop fishery AM if the overall ACL is exceeded or if the scallop sub-ACL was exceeded by 50% or more. That's not 50 cents. And then option three is sort of meant to address groundfish concerns, and the scallop fishery sub-ACL is re-estimated in January and re-specified if it will not be caught. Now, this language might seem a little odd. The original idea here was that if the scallop fishery isn't going to catch all their yellowtail, it'll be reallocated to the groundfish fishery. But for a lot of reasons, we revised that to say rather than reallocate, we're going to re-estimate it, recalculate it, and assign it that way. As I said, they're both designed to work together. They're both trying to maximize accessing the scallop resource and accessing the groundfish resource. Right now, if the scallop fishery doesn't catch all of their sub-ACL, that fish just remains uncaught. On the other hand, if the overall ACL isn't exceeded right now, the scallop fishery would still trigger AMs if they went over their sub-ACL, and they could potentially lose revenues or have to fish in more costly manners if that were to happen. Now, the next thing we're going to talk about is we will also revise the OFLs, ABCs, and ACLs, and normally many of the decisions you make before here just sort of get embodied in the ACL table. They decide what happens. I want to point out a couple things here. The first is that because the Gulf of Mankato assessment takes place after this meeting, We have written into the document a range of ABCs, a very broad range. I think it goes from 500 metric tons to 20,000 metric tons for Gulf of Maine cod, so that it will cover the likely outcomes of the December assessment. And the plan then is that the Fisheries Service, based on, well, let me back up. The plan is once the assessment is done, the SSC will meet, recommend an ABC. Ideally, that will happen in time for the council to approve the ABC at the January council meeting. And then NIMS can slam it into the proposed rule, and it can get implemented on May 1st. But there's another piece in here that's worth spending a minute or two on, I thought. Sorry, I lost my place. I got a slide out of order. Well, I'll go with where we're at. We've got a couple measures here that were being considered for a while that we're actually taking out of the document by the committee. The first is that we were talking about having a sub-ACL of Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Bite Windowpane Flounder for the scallop fishery, and for another components of the fishery that were to be determined. The history here is that we had an estimate that indicated that the scallop fishery caught on the order of 250 metric tons of windowpane flounder in 2010. That estimate turned out to be an error caused by some errors in the observer database, and the revised estimate is about 70 tons lower than that. We also had a identification that there was a lot of windowpane flounder that was caught by other fisheries, and we didn't know what those other fisheries were. The regional office has been working to identify them, and we did get a report, I think, on Monday of what they were. But the committee was looking at these measures and said there's too much uncertainty. We would rather address these in the future rather than in this framework document. There was also some interest in creating a Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Winter Flounder sub-ACL for the scallop fishery. The committee decided also to address this later because there's some evidence that we really haven't seen a lot of changes in what's being caught by the scallop fishery. It's become a bigger percentage of total removals as we've reduced removals on a number of other stocks. And then finally, there was, in October, the committee said, let's consider using the mixed stock exception for Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Bite Windowpane Flounder. We believe, though we haven't received official notice yet, we believe this stock has been rebuilt, which would allow us to use the mixed stock exception, which would potentially allow higher catchers to take place. But the concern became that there wasn't enough time to do a good analysis to justify the mixed stock exception in this document. And because this is probably, at least for our council, a groundbreaking effort, there was a lot of concern that if we're going to do this, we need to do it right. So let's take some time and figure it out rather than try and get it into Framework 47. There are a number of types of measures in the next section. They're listed on the screen. I'm not going to go over all of these because many of them are relatively easy to understand, and we can address them very quickly when the motions come up. One I am going to spend a little time talking about is the accountability measure changes that are proposed in this document. First, option one, no action, I think is worth talking about briefly because it shows why we need to address the AMs. Beginning in fishing year 2012, the common pool fishery is subject to hard tax, and there are some shortfalls in the way the AMs are described. Now, you have to remember that sectors are not allocated and cannot retain ocean pout and windowpane flounder They are not allocated halibut, but they can retain one fish per trip. And so nothing happens right present to sectors if the ACLs are exceeded for these stocks. The AM that's on the books that will go into place in 2012 is that if the ACL is exceeded of these stocks, NIMS can adjust the trip limits on the common pool. I'm not quite sure how you can adjust a zero trip limit for ocean pout and windowpane flounders and do anything. So that's one problem. And then with halibut, the issue is you can only go from one fish to no fish. So at least there is the potential for an AM. And then with respect to southern New England mid-Atlantic winter flounder and wolffish, the two other stocks that are in this, it's a little bit different. There are actually some areas that are closed to the common pool when 90% of the ACL is caught in a trimester. The problem here is that this may have worked at a time when the common pool was a significant part of the fishery, but because the common pool is a much smaller part of the fishery now, you really don't have much control on total catches if you only affect the common pool when the ACL is exceeded. So that's why we're trying to come up with better accountability measures. So option two was something that the committee and the PDT worked on since about last January, and they're area-based measures for these stocks. And the areas are a little different. In the case of ocean pout and windowpane flounder, it only applies to trawl gear. We have areas that are two sizes because at the time we started this, we thought there was a potential of a small overage and a big overage, based on some preliminary data we had. And the AM is that in these areas, trawl gear has to use selective gear, like a rule trawl, separator trawl, rope trawl. We have a number of different types. For wolffish and halibut, the measures apply to all gears, trawl and fixed gear. And we have selective gear areas for trawl gear, and we have closed areas for gillnet and long lines because we don't at present have selective gears identified for them. This is just to give you an example. These are the small areas for windowpane flounder and ocean pout, which are the same. The large areas are in your Framework 47 document. These are the halibut AM areas, and you can see that they're different for trawl gear and for fixed gear. And this is for wolffish. And there is a little bit of overlap between the fixed gear and trawl gear AM here in the inshore Gulf of Maine, but not down here out in the channel. Now, to be honest, these AM areas were greeted with some skepticism by the committee, and so they have created some additional options. One is for Atlantic halibut. As I mentioned, we have a one-fish possession limit. This would have an AM that would be no possession or landing of Atlantic halibut for commercial vessels. The measure was modified by the committee to not apply to recreational vessels, and that's the sole recreational measure we're talking about. This is a little different here in that this would apply to the entire fishery, whereas the no-action alternative would just apply to the common pool. So that makes this measure much more effective. For Atlantic wolffish, the committee took the stance that the way they look at this is that this is a proactive AM for Atlantic wolffish, where they're going to have no possession and no landing of Atlantic wolffish all the time. And so that this is viewed as a proactive AM. And if you look at the catches of wolffish last year, I mean, that you can make an argument that it does appear to be effective. We're well below the ACL for Atlantic wolffish. With respect to impacts, I'm not going to go over all the impacts of all the measures in the decision document. They're summarized a little bit. But I think it's important to note one key thing here is that in this document, as far as impacts on communities and impacts on economics, most of the measures are dwarfed by the impacts of what happens at the ACLs if the Gulf of Maine cod ACL is at the low end of the scale. And so from the standpoint of this document, if you have a Gulf of Maine cod ABC or ACL, the low end that's in the document is 500 metric tons. It clearly shows that there's huge economic impacts for the groundfish fishery compared to no action or the high value. You know, the revenues would probably take about a 20, groundfish revenues, that's not total revenue, would probably take about a 25% dip from the fishing year 2010 value, and it would probably be roughly half what it would be under the no-action alternative. And at first you may say, that doesn't seem like much, but you have to realize that that 25% is actually coming out of a very small pool of vessels that primarily coming out of the vessels that fish in the inshore Gulf of Maine. So, you know, that sole revenue impact really kind of drives the impact, economic impacts of this. Now, we did go in and analyze the economic impacts of other measures, and they are described in the document, but I think this is the key one. There's another slide that I'm going to try and get up there because I think it's relatively important for understanding the ACLs, if I can. I don't know what my problem is here. Here we go. This is a slide I was looking for before and I missed. So one of the things we do in the ACLs every year, and this was written into Amendment 16, and we did this in Framework 44 and Framework 45, is we start out with an ABC and we divvy it up to different components of the fishery. And so what the PDT has done is we went back and looked at the first year of catch information to try and decide whether we had this divvied up correctly between the components. And we looked at, you know, which components were under, which components were over, and we moved things around in order to account for that. And we will, this sort of summarizes what happens. I think the big thing to point out here is that when, rather than go through this, is that one of the big changes is that when we did this under Framework 44, in many cases it's apparent that we, I think, underestimated what was being caught within state waters. Now, we don't allocate to the states because we cannot allocate to the states in this federal plan, but what we try and do is account for what we think will be caught out of state waters. And so there's a couple relatively large changes. The Southern Mingling Mid-Atlantic Winter Flounder one is about the biggest one, where we have revised the distribution of the ABC to account for places where the components didn't match. And the big ones were the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Winter Flounder, where we had to make an adjustment based on state waters catches. And then again, in the case of Southern Windowpane, where it actually went the other way, where it appears, no, I'm sorry, Southern New England Windowpane, where we had to account for some other components besides the state waters, one of those being the scallop fishery. And these result in fairly large changes in what's available to the groundfish fleet compared to what would have been available without those particular changes. And I think that concludes my presentation, and I can answer any questions or up to the chair.
Tom, far be it from me to correct you, but your slide showing George's Bank, Yellowtail Flounder, shared tax was incorrect. It's 1150, not 1250.
Yeah, you're right.
That's okay. I just wanted to make sure that people understood that it was. Do you want to take questions now or as they relate to specific motions, and would it be better to answer them at that point?
It might be better for specific motions, I think. Then they'll be more on point for the discussion that's going on.
Okay. The chair, the groundfish chair, indicated that I would explain what we're going to do for public comment on these. I'm working from that document 1B, the Framework 47 decision document. We are going to break the public comment up into some sections here. The first area for public comment will include Section 311, which are the revised status determination criteria. And in that one, Option 2 is the committee and the AP's preferred option. 3.1.2 is the revised George's Bank Yellowtail Flounder Rebuilding Strategy. Option 2B is the committee and the AP's preferred option. And Section 3.1.4, U.S.-Canada Tax. Option 2 is the committee's preferred option. So I will open the floor to any public comments on those three measures. Deb?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gib Brogan with Oceana. I'm sorry, it's not on those three. It's the one that's in the middle, 313. If you'll allow me, I've got a question for Tom. One of the things that was moved to considered but rejected, I don't know whether there will be a motion to move those to considered but rejection. May I ask Tom a question?
You may.
Thank you. With respect to the window pane flounder and the catch of the scallop fishery, I'm playing catch up on the revised data here. You just said that the estimate is 75 tons less than was previously expected. Is that?
Sarah probably has the number right in front of her.
70. So the estimated catch of the scallop fishery is still up over 180 metric tons. Am I right that that's more than 75% of the ABC? Okay, so this isn't an insignificant amount of catch, and I was wondering about the rationale of moving this to considered but rejected. We have a clear bycatch issue with this fishery, a significant amount of the stock, which from some of the PDT discussions over the summer is not an isolated incident. And I was just wondering about the rationale for moving this to considered but rejected, and think that this probably needs some discussion. Thank you.
Anyone else? Vito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the only opportunity for the public to comment on all the series of stuff. Just going by memory.
Just on these three items, and then there'll be a late subsequent to that will be the next batch of items.
Specifically to the revised rebuilding program for George's Bank Yellowtail. At the Groundfish Committee meeting, there was a discussion about, a stepwise F rebuild going on that would involve at least if there was a 10% increase, I think, in the stock. And I had a question about whether that was an expectation that was compounding or how that evaluation was going to be done. And I think Tom gave a shot at an answer on that, but I really would love to, we're concerned about this look to have a consistent 10% trajectory going all the way, that I don't see it as being an improvement to the current rebuilding regimes that we have. So I just wanted to make sure that we weren't setting up a bar that unless you achieved that 10% increase in a compound manner that all of a sudden that we wouldn't be able to go along with the track recommendations. So I was... Initially, we were favorable to the revised rebuilding plan, but I'm a little concerned about that annual evaluation of the 10%. Just if the council could have a detailed discussion about that, it would help the public understand what we're really looking for.
Tom, did you have a comment on that? Or?
Yeah, I think that's kind of a misinterpretation of the rebuilding strategy. The rebuilding strategy amounts to an end date and a probability of success. We want to rebuild by 2032 at a 50% probability of success. The way we got that date is we said, how long would it take at an average annual increase of 10%, or the maximum F that will achieve our rebuilding target? It turns out they come out to the same F rate over that period and the same timeline, but the committee was actually originally thinking of two different alternatives. Turns out they have the same answer. So the strategy is rebuild by 2032 with a median probability. The strategy is not try and get a 10% increase every year. So just as an example, to make it clear to people, if it increased 5% 1 year, we're not shooting for a, 25% increase the next year, whatever it takes to, 15% increase the next year to get 10% per year. At the end of the year, we'd say, where are we and what F do we need to get from here to rebuild to 2032? And that's what we would base the catch on, or that's what we would hope the TMGC would produce a catch that's consistent with it. Now, that, you know, just to be upfront with people, early in the rebuilding period, when you got a lot of time, that's going to result in relatively minor changes in your F rate from 1 year to the next. But if you allow yourself to fall too far behind, as the time left in the rebuilding period gets shorter and shorter, you're going to have to make much larger changes. So, you know, you may decide that that's not aggressive enough for you when you see that happen, because you don't want to get yourself in a bind down near the end of the rebuilding program.
Thank you, Tor.
Yeah.
Any other public comments on these three items? Back to the council. Terry.
You ready, Mr. Chairman? I move on behalf of the committee to select option 2 as a preferred alternative for status determination criteria, section 3.1.1.2. This motion passed the committee 10-01 and the groundfish advisors 13-0.
That's a committee motion. Doesn't need a second. Discussion.
Option 2B.
Tom, when we're discussing putting in these broad things on the Gulf of Maine cod, is there an option available to us once we get the final figures to deal with a possible extension of the rebuilding timelines in the current document, or would we need to do something now on that? If, for instance, you hear rumors that we can't rebuild by the end of the time period and things like that.
There's nothing in the document that explicitly addresses that right now.
So then we would need to put something in now, or is there something that explicitly prevents us from doing that later? You know, we're putting in a broad range of options for catch, but we're not dealing at all with the rebuilding timelines.
I'm hesitating to answer here because I think there's embedded in your question is some legal policy questions that I think the service is the one to answer. Should it turn out that we can't, I mean, I'll give you the example of Southern New England winter flounder. We reached the point where we could not rebuild, according to most recent assessment info, we can't rebuild that stock by 2014. And the guidance from the service was not that we recalculated the rebuilding strategy. The guidance from the service for that stock was to fish as close to zero as possible and try and rebuild as quickly as possible. So it's not clear to me whether, in the case of Gulf of Maine cod, the guidance would be the same at this stage of the rebuilding program, or if the guidance is that, yes, there's going to be an opportunity to alter the rebuilding program somehow.
Well, then I guess I'd like to follow up and ask the service that if we find that we can't rebuild in the timeline of Gulf of Maine cod in the timeline available, or if we find that the targets are wrong or anything like that, what kind of ability do we have to address the rebuild timelines, if any?
Pat.
You can't adjust the rebuilding timelines simply because you're not going to achieve rebuilding by the end date. There is guidance the National Standard 1 guidance addresses what happens if you're unable to build by the end of the rebuilding time period. And essentially, you need to go to 75% of FMSY or F rebuild, whichever is lower. I think the other question you may be asking, though, is if we find that for some reason the rebuilding time period could have been longer, had we known what we know now, that would take, if that's true, and we don't know right now if that's true, but if it were, then it would require a framework to change the rebuilding time period.
So I understand that we would need a framework. So what I'm trying to get at is how do we build that into this action? You know, we've built in a very broad range of catches anticipating something, and I would like to be able to build in to this action something that would allow us to address the rebuild timeline if we had known what we know now 3 years ago. And so I'm struggling with that. I don't know if it's possible. I don't know how to do it. Short of, we'd have to start another framework.
Yeah, honestly, I don't think you can do that in this action. I think it would require you to set the harvest limits for 2012 based on the current rebuilding period, revise the rebuilding period, and then readjust the harvest limits.
Any other questions, comments? Ready for the question? All those in favor of the motion so indicate. Opposed? Abstention? Sherry, did you want to vote on this? No, I said Sherry. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see it. So it's 16. I'm sorry. 16-0-0. Motion carries. Terry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move on behalf of the committee to select option 2, sub-option B, as preferred alternative for Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder Rebuilding Section 3.1.2.2. This motion passed the committee 9-0-2 and the advisors 13-0.
Committee motion, no second required. Discussion. Ready for the question? All those in favor, so indicate. I think we're down to 15 votes at the moment, so unanimous, 15-0. Sure, okay. Thank you, George. 15-0-1, the motion carries. Terry?
The next two motions are to postpone until the next groundfish action, but I move on behalf of the committee that the council will address option 2, Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Windowplane Flounder Sub-ACL Section 3.1.3 in the next groundfish action. It passed the committee 10-0-1, and there is no advisor's recommendation.
Committee motion, no second required. Discussion. Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I think Rip had asked a question about this. I think, it should be stated for the record that the reason the committee did this is the considerable confusion around the windowpane catch and the fact that, you know, we've already discovered one error. We're not convinced that there aren't others, especially as they apply to groundfish as well, and that, we just felt that this was the best thing to do with this at this time until we get to the bottom of these problems with the recording of the window pane catch. So it isn't that we just didn't want to do it. It's that we just can't rely on the information we currently have.
Further discussion? Call the question. All those in favor so indicate. Terry.
I move on behalf of the committee that the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Winter Flounder Sub-ACL and the Scallop Fishery be delayed until the next groundfish action. Option 3, Section 3.1.3. This passed the committee 10-01.
Committee motion. No second required. Discussion. Call the question. All those in favor so indicate. 15 in favor, opposed, abstention. Would you like a little 15-01. The motion carries. Terry.
I move on behalf of the committee to select.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I had to take that call. I did actually want to speak to this motion. We had sent a letter to the council when we approved Amendment 16 saying that we needed to implement AMs in this fishery or for this segment of the fishery. And I understand that the committee has looked at the information from the first year and determined that that really the what's in place is working and is acting effectively as an AM. And so I think the council has really two choices here. And again, I really apologize for missing that motion. But one of them is to adopt an AM for this fishery. And the second one is really to adopt what you're currently doing as an AM instead of moving it to considered rejected. But formally adopting it as an AM.
Pat, this for
this one. I'm sorry.
Are we okay?
So you're not ahead of me. Sorry. So I wasted my speech. It's for later. Sorry.
Terry.
You all set? Okay, I'm going to move on behalf of the committee to select option 2 for the U.S.-Canada TACs, section 3.1.4.2. This motion passed the committee 11-01 with no advisor's recommendation.
Committee motion, no second required. Discussion. Call the question. All those in favor so indicate. 15 opposed, abstention. 15-01, motion carries. We are on to the second, wait a minute, I'm sorry, you've got one more? No? Oh, no. Okay. We're on to the second group for public comment, starting with 3.1.6, administration of scallop fishery sub-ACLs. Option 2 and option 3 are the preferred options for the AP and the committee. Section 3.1.7, the ACL specifications. Option 2 is the preferred for the AP and the committee. 3.2.1, measures for Southern New England Mid-Atlantic winter flounder. Option 1, no action, is preferred by the committee. And 3.2.2, scallop catch of yellowtail flounder in Georges Bank access area. Option 2 is preferred by the committee. I will open it to public comment on those items. Gibb?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gibb Brogan with Oceana. Commenting on 3.2.1, the measure for Southern New England Mid-Atlantic winter flounder. The no action right now was highlighted in the approval of Amendment 16 as being deficient, that this is not an accountability measure. And we continue to believe that zero possession only pushes things from the landings and to the discard pile, but it's all part of catch. It all needs to be accounted for under an annual catch limit. And whether it's landed or discarded, it's still catch. And pushing things to discards is not only contrary to National Standard 1, but also to National Standard 9. It's our feeling that if you're going to catch these fish, they should come ashore. And the number that's been assigned to this of $4.7 million of foregone catch or foregone landings in a fishery, we're trying to make as much money as possible. Those fish, if they're going to be caught, should be brought to the dock. Wasting them is unthinkable, and this stock should be allocated to the fishery and brought to shore. Best use, you name it, optimum yield. These fish should be allocated to the sectors and brought to shore. No discards is just the wrong way to go. Thank you. Or all discards.
Further public comment? Back to the council. Terry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is also a motion to defer to the next groundfish action. And I'm going to move on behalf of the committee that the council remove section 3.1.5 from framework 47 and will consider the mixed stock exemption for Southern New England Mid-Atlantic bite windowpane flounder in the next groundfish action. This motion passed the committee 9-1-0. And however, the groundfish advisors recommended option 2, which was to invoke the mixed stock exception.
That is, committee motion doesn't require a second. My mistake on that, Terry, I got to open it back up for public comment if there is any public comment on that one in particular, because I did skip over that. Okay, back to the council discussion. Dave Gaisel.
Well, I'm the one who opposed this, so I just thought I ought to at least speak a little bit on the record as to why. I think we have to flesh out this mixed stock exception argument and get on with it. I've been a proponent of using this right along. But the problem here from the committee's perspective was one of timing, that it would slow down the amendment. And I understand that. But the other issue is this one of when it's going to be declared rebuilt. And I don't know if we have any updated information on that. At the time we had the committee meeting, my understanding was we were expecting it any day, but we didn't have it at the time. And I was wondering if it's a question. Have we got updated information?
Tom.
There's A couple issues with window pane flounder. The first with southern window pane flounder, the first and the easiest one to talk about is it's assessed solely by a survey, and the Bigelow does not cover the same survey strata as the albatross. It doesn't cover a couple of the inshore strata. And so but it's not really correct to just take the Bigelow survey and apply it to the time series. So what really needs to happen is the Bigelow survey needs to be rerun through the AIM, through the assessment model, the index-based model, with the new strata for the whole time series, which gives you slightly different reference points in all probability. It may give you a slightly different answer. That is some of the work that the center was actually working on. They were nearly complete with it and reviewing it when some of the problems came to light about the window pane discard estimates, which changes the catch stream, which changes their assessment results. So they got to go back and redo it. And so that's the issue why we haven't received at least their report yet, because they have to redo it. The timing is such that now I think they're in the point of saying, okay, do we redo it now, where it's unlikely they're going to do the mixed stock exception in this framework, or do we do it once as part of the groundfish assessments that are coming up in January, February? I'm not sure where they're coming down on that, but that's what they're wrestling with.
Yeah, that's helpful, and I think it's good to have this on the record, because it's not that we don't want to do it; it's that we can't really do it until it's declared rebuilt, and since it's not declared rebuilt, we can't invoke the mixed stock exception. So it's a convoluted way of saying we're kind of stuck. If we want to submit this framework in a timely manner, we have to move on, but it isn't that we want to give up the argument. So I just wanted that all on the record.
Further discussion? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion so indicate. 15 in favor, opposed, 0, abstention, 1, 15-01. Terry.
I move on behalf of the committee that the council select options 2, section 3.1.6.2, and option 3, section 3.1.6.3, as preferred alternatives in section 3.1.6. And to include the groundfish advisor's suggestion for adding an additional criteria for the trigger, that the AM is triggered if the scallop fishery sub-ACL is exceeded by 50% or more. This motion passed the committee 901 and the advisors 13-0.
Committee motion doesn't require a second. Discussion. Pat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On option 3, at this point, we don't think option 3 is feasible, just given the timeliness of the information and our ability to project accurately with that information in such a way that we wouldn't jeopardize or potentially cause the scallop ACL to be exceeded. The observer information right now just isn't timely enough for us to be able to do this by January 15th and then get something in place in time for it to benefit people before the end of the fishing year. So option 3 from our perspective just isn't going to work.
Pat, from a process standpoint, if that stays in, then does that become part of this action, which essentially that service would reject because it's not doable?
I certainly think there's a possibility we would disapprove it if it stayed in.
That section, or the
That section.
Mary Beth.
Well, I think that these types of measures do need to be developed in a number of plans. The ability to roll fish over that's going to be unused is a mechanism that is used in other regions in the country on a regular basis, and it's done so that fisheries can achieve optimum yield in those fisheries. Clearly, in this situation, Pat's indicating it's a data issue. and that, you know, this example, she doesn't feel they can really do it. So I'm just curious if we can leave the concept in this framework and perhaps not implement the actual dates and numbers, and maybe the system can catch up. I mean, otherwise we're left with, in the future, no ability to roll it over. So I guess the question I'm asking is, can we put a provision in this framework that would allow rollovers to occur if they if the estimates are robust enough to do it, versus the way it reads here, which is very specific, we're going to do this on a specific date with, do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, and I agree with you, and we don't have any concern with the concept, just our ability to implement it. And so I do think that a potential option is for you to leave it in the document and say, should the information, you know, should we ever get to the point where the information is timely enough that we could use this tool? I mean, that's an option.
Tom has this.
Tom.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little confused because I think the scallop AM for yellowtail flounder requires an estimate of the yellowtail catch by either January 1st or January 15th, and that information is deemed reliable enough to trigger the AM for the scallop fishery. So that's why we were thinking that the information would be available at the same time and be considered reliable enough to determine whether there's fish available for the groundfish fishery. Because it just seemed like if it's going to be used to trigger the scallop AM, then it might be appropriate to use it in a slightly different way.
Right.
Well, so that's true, and what we found out is that we last year, if we had used the information in January, we would have triggered the AM and subsequently found out that we shouldn't have triggered the AM. And so through this learning curve process, we're realizing that we certainly don't want to make the same mistake again, basically.
Further discussion. Mary Beth.
I'm not sure that I can come up with an amendment to this motion. If we could, Pat could just repeat herself, we could do it.
You might simply say that under option 3, if the information is available in a timely fashion. I think that's what Pat.
That's probably sufficient. And as I said, I was really trying to just preserve the opportunity for the tool to be available, because otherwise, when other issues come up, and it's come up before, if it's not already in the plan in some fashion, it's not available without an additional framework. So that was my intention.
So, I'm sorry, were you making a motion to amend? Okay. Is there a second to that? Dave Gaethel? Discussion on the motion to amend.
Maybe something like delay in, motion to delay implementation of option three until the observer data becomes available in a timely enough way to implement it, or something along that line.
Mary Beth, do you like the wordsmithing on that?
We're feeling pretty friendly to wordsmithing it, and I think Tom has some thoughts on that as well.
I think that we have information. I think the issue is that we have information now available, but it's the quality control that we're concerned about. It's how accurately that is going to jibe with. We have information now to make a choice. It's the decision of whether it's sufficient or adequate basis to make the right choice. Is that right?
It's the timeliness.
Tom?
So I was dangerous trying to think on the fly here, but I was talking to Deirdre a little bit. I think in recent years, at least with Georges Bank yellowtail flounder, the scallop fishery has caught on the order of 15 or 20% of their sub-ACL. Next year, 15 or 20% of the, well, if 75% of the scallop fishery sub-ACL isn't caught, that's a pretty big chunk of fish, given the size of the Georges Bank yellowtail. So I'm wondering if there's any chance that the service would consider some sort of break point where they might have more comfort in doing this. And I'm just thinking out loud, and would if it's worth pursuing, maybe we should table this and think about it a little bit first. But some sort of break point where you say, look, if by January they've only caught 15 or 20%, if we think that's all we've got, then we might be more willing, or we might be willing to release part of it, or some sort of language like that. The problem this year, I believe, was with the southern New England mid-Atlantic yellowtail flounder estimate. If Deirdre might be able to address this better than I can, but I think generally most of the Georges yellowtail comes out of the access area, which is typically the access area program is over with or almost over with earlier in the fishing year than January, which gives a little bit of time for some of this stuff to catch up. So while maybe it wouldn't work in southern New England yellowtail, it might work on Georges yellowtail, for example.
I really don't have anything to add. That's all correct. The fishery for the last few years has not been catching as much Georges Bank yellowtail as predicted. And I think that is a lot of the reason that the Groundfish Committee didn't spend a lot of time looking at that allocation of Georges Bank yellowtail because of this added flexibility that was developed instead. So a choke amount or a certain thing, we can maybe try to address this differently. But, yes, most Georges Bank fishing and bycatch happens earlier in the year. I know there is a pretty big delay, and it's still in the order of 6 months after trips are taken to get through the observer program, which is long, but they are shortening that each year, from what I understand, would be the only thing I would add.
For clarification, Pat, this wording works for what you would need?
I don't think it's pretty, but I think it works.
And I just want to make sure that I understood. Tom, do you necessarily have a problem with the way that this is?
I think the answer is no. This might, let me back up. I think the answer that this might work as long as the service is willing to consider that they may not have the info in a timely enough fashion for one stock, but it might be available quickly enough for the other stock, just because of the way the fisheries are prosecuted.
Not for Georges.
Right. This is only for George's. I apologize. This is only for George's. So in the case of George's Bank yellowtail flounder, you know, the season is over earlier in the year for the most part. I mean, this is potentially a real concern next year because the allocation to the scallop fishery is a pretty big chunk of the 564 metric tons that the U.S. fishery is going to get. And so, you know, if you're talking about having half, probably, your fish uncaught, that's a real problem next year for the groundfish fishery. So, you know, I'm just trying to think of a mechanism to keep the door open that there's a possibility that this may get slid over to the groundfish fishery. If this is it, it may work. The problem we had with the estimate was on southern New England yellowtail flounder, not on Jordan's.
Further discussion? Pat?
Yeah, I hate doing stuff on the fly like this, too, but I'm hear what Tom is saying, and I wonder if we couldn't agree to, you know, with some understanding from the council, if this passes, to work with Tom and Deirdre to craft some language that says, that allows us to make the decision about whether or not we think the information is adequate or not, and then perhaps not to make a full transfer. I mean, down to the last pound, this is the way we, you know, this is what we estimate won't be used, and therefore we transfer every single pound, but allow us to have some sort of buffer in the event that we're not completely comfortable with the information. If we craft the language in that way, I think we'd feel a lot more comfortable with it.
Dave Gaisel.
I don't want to speak for everybody on the council, but at least what I'm concerned with is getting the concept up here and through the regulatory process, the review process and everything, so that it's a concept that we can use. So if, you know, if the respective parties are comfortable with a negotiation on the exact wording of this, you know, I'm comfortable with just moving it ahead because I want the concept fleshed out more than anything else.
Jim?
Well, maybe I can offer a friendly following up on, since we're trying to work on the fly, that after a way to implement it, we have a comma with considerations for uncertainty. And my intent with that would be that would give the service the flexibility to hold back some percentage that if they start to feel uncomfortable with some of the data. I'm just trying to move this along.
Maker and the seconder agree with that? Great. Thank you. Pat.
And Chris just pointed out that we have the deeming process to look at the specific language, so I would advise that the council try to take the opportunity to do that in the way that you did the scallop deeming this morning, just to make sure everybody's comfortable with it.
Further discussion on the motion to amend? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion to amend, so indicate. Unanimous. We're on to the main motion as amended. Further discussion. Call the question. All those in favor, so indicate. 16. Opposed. Abstention. 1. 16-0-1. Terry.
Moving on. I move on behalf of the committee that the council select option 2, section 3.1.7.2, for the revised ACL specifications as a preferred alternative. This motion passed the committee 10-0-0 and the advisors 13-0.
Committee motion, no second. Discussion. Tom?
I guess I just had a question on process and how to deal with the GOM-COD issue that we briefly discussed before. Pat, you raised the question of, or the lingering question of, if we knew then what we believe we know now, or is becoming more clear, what would the rebuilding program would have looked like, and what would the timeline have been? Does the council need to address that question to anyone? Does it need to be answered, or could we start the wheels turning in a way that answers that, so that we can deal with the possible looming issue with GOM-COD? Do we need to direct the SSC to do that? I don't think it's going to come through the assessment advice.
No, it certainly won't come directly through the assessment advice, but as we understand better, we, the agency, understands better what's going to come out of the assessment advice, that's something we would be looking at. So.
Just a question on process. Is there anything that the council can proactively do at this point to move that process along or better prepare for a really dismal answer out of that assessment and the potential that we need to extend the rebuilding timeline in order to avoid some of the negative consequences?
No, I mean, I think we all need to wait for the assessment results. I think, you know, in Eric Schwab's letter, he mentioned that he would strongly encourage that the industry and the council and we start discussions about what some of our options are should, in fact, the assessment end up as low as some of the numbers we've seen. And so I think that's worthwhile to try to pursue. But right now, we still need to let the assessment process play itself out.
Further discussion? Call the question. All those in favor, so indicate. Opposed, 0, abstention, 1, 16, 0, 1, motion carries.
I move on behalf of the committee that the council selects option 1, no action for the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Winter Flounder Management Measures, section 3.2.1.1. This motion passed the committee 901, and there is no recommendation from the advisors.
Committee motion, no second required. Pat.
So this is where my speech comes in, the one I made earlier. So I believe that the council is trying to make the argument that, in fact, you effectively have an AM in place, and so you either need an AM or you need to justify that, in fact, you do have an AM. And so, again, I would suggest that the council, instead of moving this to considered and rejected, be very clear in the document that you're adopting the status quo as the AM and that you consider this to be the AM.
Well, I think this is kind of like down the line of, some conversations we'll have coming forward. But for the record, I think that a zero possession limit with the evidence that we have that we're well below the OFL is the best AM we can have. It's a proactive AM, and that we think this is the AM that is needed in this particular fisheries. It's quite clear to me from past experience with yellowtails at zero possession at times and this one that it's absolutely working, and that if you start directing to fishing to this stock, you'll have much higher catch rates and much higher discards. So I think this should be considered a proactive AM.
Further discussion? Tom.
Tom.
Well, we'll go back to the first Tom and then the second Tom.
I was just going to point out that there sort of is a Southern New England Mid-Atlantic winter flounder AM default. So if the argument is going to be made that this is the AM, it might be helpful if you actually wrote it into the motion so that we clear out that other thing that will just confuse people down the road.
Tom Dempsey.
I think you chose the wrong Tom first. I would offer an amended motion to select option one, zero possession limit, the no action alternative, and identify that option as the accountability measure for the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic winter flounder management.
Got a second? Jim?
I'll second it, but I think we ought to insert the word a proactive accountability measure into the motion and then second it.
Okay, discussion. Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Tom and Jim. This is exactly the substance of the committee's discussion about the nature of option one being a proactive accountability measure, and it's going to hold through as we continue a number of our other motions.
Further discussion? Dave Gaethel.
I think you do have to say for the record that, you know, basically, I hate to argue with success. I mean, I'm extremely sympathetic to this idea of apportioning the fish and not having them discarded. But for the first time in I don't know how many years, we're meeting the targets of what we're supposed to hit for fishing targets. So, you know, how can we argue with success? It appears to work, at least with this stock.
Further discussion? Call a question on the motion to amend. All those in favor? Seventeen zero zero. Unanimous. We're on the main motion as amended. Further discussion? Call the question. All those in favor, so indicate. 16. Opposed. Abstention. 1. 16-01. Terry.
I move on behalf of the committee that the council select option 2, section 3.2.2.2, as a preferred alternative, and that is to eliminate the 10% cap on the yellowtail flounder caught in the Georgia's Bank access areas. Pass the committee 901 with no recommendation from the advisors.
Committee motion, no second required. Discussion. Call the question. All those in favor, so indicate. 16. Opposed. 0. Abstention. 1. 16-01. That brings us to the third grouping of actions for public comment. We will start with 3.2.3, Atlantic Wolffish Landing Limit. Option one, no action, was the committee preferred. 3.2.4, Common Pool Restriction Gear Areas. Common Pool Restricted Gear Areas. Option two was eliminate restricted gear areas. That was both the committee and the AP. And 3.2.5, accountability measures. Option two was a committee preferred. Option three and option four were committee and AP. I will open it up to public comment. Maggie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. Actually have a question on the accountability measures and the economic analysis. And I recognize that the decision document has a disclaimer that says that this summary cannot capture all the impacts described in the document. But if you look at those, some of those impacts, and the first of all, I don't see Portland listed too many places, so I'm wondering if that means because all the boats have moved to Massachusetts. Or, but also, it's hard for me to square what's in this document with the little summary that's on the decision document. There's some pretty significant impacts of these measures, particularly to the ports of New Bedford and Gloucester and some of the smaller ports as well, you know, when you compare, when you look at Chatham, for example. What am I missing that says that, how are they going to make up these revenues in some other way? How are they going to make up $3 million or $1.8 million? It doesn't make sense to me. And I'm probably missing something, so that's why I'm asking a question. Thanks.
Tom.
I think there's two possible ways. With respect to all gears, these areas are relatively, well, not all of them. One of the areas is fairly large. The large AM area for window pane and ocean pout is pretty large. But with respect to trawl gear, they can make up the revenues either by using, partially at least, by using selective gear in the area to target some species but not all. And they're allowed to fish in other areas, so they can fish in other areas, which may increase their costs but might be able to increase some of their revenues. With respect to fixed gear, those areas are closures, but they can go and fish in other areas. Now, one of the things that troubled us a little bit when we did these analyses is that, as you can tell if you read it, it's based on VTR reports. And we were somewhat surprised with some of the fixed gear areas, I think the ones in the Gulf of Maine, at how few fixed gear trips were actually reported in the VTRs as taking place in those areas. But this is an issue with the data we have in order to analyze it. There's not much that we can do to get around it. But it is possible, at least for the gear, it is possible, so that basically it's two ways. Trawl gear can use some sort of selective gear in the area and target haddock, which in some of the areas is a big part of the revenues anyway. And then with all of the gears, they can redirect into other areas.
Gibb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gibb Brogan. I've just got a question on the decision document, and I think it may be a typo. On 3.2.5, option 2, it lists in bold area-based AMs for four stocks. Is that correct, or did the committee take action that it would only apply to two stocks? Is that?
Well, the option in the text is I think there's probably actually five stocks if you count both windowpane flounder stocks. But anyway, the measure in the document is for more than that. But I believe when we get to the committee motion, their motion is only to do it for certain stocks.
Okay.
To adopt option two for certain stocks.
Okay. In that case, we support area-based AMs for all of these stocks and think that that should be applied across the board. They may not be perfect, but they're a good start and can be fine-tuned in the future. This is a true meaningful AM that will control mortality or control catch in the fishery, as AMs are intended to do, provide real accountability for the fishery, and it should apply to all of them. Thank you.
Further public comment? Back to the council. Terry.
I move on behalf of the committee that the council select option one, no action as a preferred alternative for Atlantic Wolffish landing limits, section 3.2.3.1. This motion was approved by the committee 901 and the advisors 9-3.
Committee motion, no second required. Discussion. Dave Gaisel.
Actually, I have a question for Tom. It's related to document 1A that they were discussing a few minutes ago. I'm just waiting till like you all set, Tom, because you're gonna okay on table. Let's see here, it's page 3, table 5. There's a port listed as Belmar, New Hampshire, and I'm just curious what it's really supposed to be.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm going to have to check. I'm suspecting it's really New Jersey, but I'm not even sure of that, to be honest.
That's what I suspected, but I just wanted to know, so I just ask you to note it to check it and revise it. Thank you.
Frank?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is probably for the service. On this particular motion, should we do the same thing that we did for Southern New England winter flounder and say that this is a proactive AM?
So, Sarah and I were just discussing that, actually, and I think we decided that it would be more appropriate under 3.2.5 when you talk about option 4, but you could do it either, but that's really where the accountability measure is.
Further comment? Call the question. All those in favor, so indicate. That's unanimous at the moment. Terry.
I move on behalf of the committee that the council selects option 2 as a preferred alternative for common pool restricted gear areas, section 3.2.4.2. This motion passed the committee 7-2-1 and the advisors 11-1.
Committee motion, no second required. Discussion. Ready for the motion? All those in favor, so indicate. 15, opposed, abstention, 1. 15-01 carries.
I move on behalf of the committee that the council select sub-option 2 as a preferred alternative for timing of revised AMs, section 3.2.5. This motion passed the committee 10-0-0 and the advisors 13-0.
Committee motion doesn't require a second. Discussion. Tom, the right Tom.
This is, I don't think this is actually in the decision document that we have in front of us. It's, at least not that I see. I remember the discussion at the committee table, but it's actually not in this document. It was regarding when the accountability measure would actually be implemented.
Tom?
So what happened at the committee? In the draft document, if you read the draft document, you have some accountability measures, and then in each accountability measure, it has a sub-option for timing. And what the committee did is, rather than vote on that each time, they said, let's just go with a sub-option for timing for all of them. And so that's why it's not in the decision document, because it's not separated out in the actual framework document. And to be clear, what happens here is that if there's an overage in year one, we count the fish in year two, and the AM is implemented, I believe, in year three is the way that works.
Further discussion? Call the question. All those in favor, so indicate. Opposed, abstention, 1. 16-01. Motion carries.
I move on behalf of the committee that the council selects option 2, section 3.2.5.2, as a preferred alternative for ocean pout and windowpane flounder accountability measures. This motion passed at committee 10-00, and there was no recommendation from the advisors.
This was the one that wasn't in the decision document. What's that?
This is in the decision document, except the committee motion differs a little from what's in the framework document. The framework document AM area would apply it to all four stocks. The committee just recommended approval for these two of the four.
Now I'm getting it. Thank you. Discussion? Dr. Pierce.
Yes, sorry, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification regarding the motion and the specific areas that would apply for window pane. I'm just a bit confused. Where in the document itself, we note AM areas small, page 41, which is a relatively small area off of the southwestern portion of closed area two, and then AM area large is a rather large area taking up the entire western side of closed area two. So I just need a clarification as to what area would apply with this particular motion if adopted.
Tom.
The idea here is that we have a small area and a large area so that the measure is somewhat scalable. The small area would apply for overages of, I believe it's up to 20%, and then the large area applies to any overage over 20%. And I would also call your attention to the fact that, you know, there was some concern about expressed at the committee about triggering these areas for, you know, a full year for a small overage. But if you read the text, what we've got in the text here is that the overages are implemented if the ACL overage is between the management uncertainty buffer and 20%. So there is, in essence, a little bit of a buffer that prevents from us from triggering the whole area for a very minor, you know, 1 or 2% overage.
Okay, thanks.
Anything else on this? Ready for the question? All those in favor, so indicate. 16-01, motion carries.
I move on behalf of the committee that the council selects as a preferred alternative for Atlantic Halibut the no possession AM, option 1, sub-option B, section 3.2.5.3. This AM applies to commercial vessels only. This motion was amended on a show of hands, 9-01, and the advisor's recommendation was 11-1.
Committee motion doesn't require a second. Discussion? Ready for the question? All those in favor, so indicate. Opposed, abstention, 16-01.
I move on behalf of the committee that the council selects as a preferred alternative, option 1, proactive AM of no possession for Atlantic Wolffish, section 3.2.5.4. The motion passed the committee 7-01 and the advisors 11-1.
Committee motion doesn't require a second. Discussion. Pat.
So this is the one where I would encourage you to have a motion similar to the earlier one adopting this as an AM.
Pat, up on the board, the wording that came out said a proactive AM. Okay. For the discussion, Frank.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to support this motion, but I have a question for Tom. If this didn't go through and you went with the area management, the areas that were picked out by the PDT assume that the year-round closures would still be there, correct? And if those were to go away, you would have to do something additional?
We'd probably have to revisit them, yes.
Would they have to be revisited if this option is chosen, if that's our only AM? Is it likely, if those areas are opened up for species such as wolffish, that we may be increasing the catch beyond?
Well, I don't know. We haven't analyzed that yet. I mean, it is entirely possible that if you open up, for example, the Western Gulf of Maine closed area, that there may be more interactions with wolffish.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Ready for the question? All those in favor, so indicate. Opposed, abstention, 16-01. Terry.
Here's the motion everyone's been waiting for. It's not a committee motion. I'm making a motion to submit framework 47 as amended to the Northeast Multispecies FMP to the RA for approval and implementation.
Is there a second? Dave Preble. Discussion. Call the question. All those in favor, so indicate. 16 opposed, 0 abstention, 1. 16-01. Terry, thank you. I think we have been at this for quite a bit. I would ask that we keep it to a 10-minute break. There are people I know that are waiting for us to finish up on this in the public, so let's try and get a 10-minute break and be back here at 4:05. Terry, back to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are four more committee motions. And the first is in reference to the recreational accountability measures. And I move on behalf of the committee that the council recommend that the three measures possible as recreational M's, that the service should consider a bag limit first, a minimum size second, and a closed season last. This motion was passed by the committee 9-0-2.
Okay, I will open the floor for public comment on this. Patrick. Then Tom after that. The third Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Patrick Paquette, I'm a recreational advocate from Massachusetts. I just wanted to make sure that the council was aware that deep in the weeds of the overage that that ends up bringing this motion before you is are some numbers that my community finds bizarre. I mean, beyond like questionable or bad science, but the fact that the overage is based on or the bulk of the landings appear to be from private vessels in Massachusetts state water in March and April, when the bulk of the private fleet isn't even in the water yet. In an area that I actually grew up personally and still am invested in a small charter boat there, that we don't fish for haddock in those months inshore. And I think that I think it's also fair to say that the charter boats that are fishing don't even necessarily go haddock fishing at that time of the year, because they'd have to drive over like a significant body of codfish to get there. And codfish being the sexy fish for the clients, it's just bizarre, the numbers that sort of drove this overage. And I know that, like, everybody is tired of hearing us scream about how bad the MRF data is, and that the MRIP input end is nowhere close to coming before us. But my understanding is that the trajectory for the same fishery for this year is well below, and that there is an allowance that the council might be able to recommend to NIMS that because in the immediate following year we're going to be significantly under the overage, that there's some sort of a loophole. And I just wanted to really strongly urge you to consider that there is some truly bizarre numbers that don't match the behavior of the private recreational community that seems to be being blamed, or that the numbers they're just bizarre. I mean, most of the places that this community would actually go into the water and aren't even open in March. It really is. It's frightening if the numbers this bad are going to be used. And I just would like you to consider that as you go through this discussion. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom.
Barry Gibson couldn't be here, so he asked me to make the wrap report, which I will, and I'd like to make my own comments after that. Wrap vote. The Recreational Advisory Panel met on November 1st to decide on the accountability measures for a 22% overage on haddock that National Marine Fisheries Service says occurred during the 2010 fishing year. After several hours of deliberation, the RAP voted to increase the minimum size for haddock by no more than 2 inches. According to National Marine Fisheries Service, an increase of increase to 21 inches would provide a 37.6% reduction in mortality. So the RAP ballparked the 20-inch minimum to provide what they felt would be the necessary reduction. Concerns expressed. The RAP wanted to state on the record that they had a number of concerns about attempting to come up with an appropriate accountability measure. Number one, MRF's data was used to calculate the haddock overage. This system has been characterized as fatally flawed and was never intended to be used for management purposes in the first place. We were told by NIMS that MREP data would presumably be more accurate is not yet available. Number two, the REP did not have enough information or tools to be able to determine the best course of action for creating the AM. We did not have any concrete data on bag limits or minimum sizes that would meet the reduction goal. Number three, the RAP voted to ask the council to include a provision in the next ground fish amendment to allow for the transfer of uncaught fish within the total TAC from the commercial section to the recreational sector and vice versa. This type of provision is contained in other management plans but was left out of recent ground fish amendment. Any questions? Okay, I'd like to make my own comments. I'm here to express my deep concern over the recent decision of the Ground Fish Committee to recommend a haddock bag limit as the AM for a 22% catch overage by RECs in 2010. The RAP voted to instead go with an increased size limit from 18 inches to 20 inches. It is disturbing to me that the Ground Fish Committee rejected the RAP's voted recommendation, since the size limit was one of the tools provided to us by NIMS and the council staff. The size limit is a conservation equivalent to the bag limit. Please let us choose our own poison. As you are aware, our cod season has been reduced by 5.5 months. During November 1st to April 15th, the off season, we tried to book some charters by targeting haddock. The perception of no bag limit entices some people to make a trip, even though the average catch is only 9 to 10 fish per person, according to the National Marine Fisheries Service. A bag limit of 7 haddock, which is the recommendation, will eliminate virtually all off-season trips for us. This is our only source of income during the 5.5 month cod closure, and will prevent us from paying our mortgage, boat payments, car loans, and feeding our kids. The MRFS data has been proven to be as much as 400% inaccurate. I don't believe these numbers for the RECs had a catch. With $4 a gallon fuel prices, people will not travel 30 miles out to catch small haddock while driving over 10 miles of much larger codfish and pollock. I urge the council to consider the RAP's vote to increase the minimum size on haddock. This will provide the needed AM without eliminating the all-important haddock trips that allow many of us to get by in the off-season between November 1st and April 15th. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Kevin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Captain Kevin Twombly. I run Cayman Charters in Gloucester, and I also represent the Northeast Charter Boat Association, which has approximately 150 members. I don't want to repeat what Mr. DePerge just said about the decision that the RAP made. They felt that the measures that would satisfy, if we could go with the no bag limit instead of the size, would be able to keep our jobs and would still satisfy the recommendations. But I'm also here to express today the devastation to the charter and party fleet that this would cause. As you know, we're out of business 5.5 months a year, and in the cold winter months, we don't get the charter boat people that are coming up for a day with a picnic. You know, everybody envisions the charter boat with the outboard with the fancy shiny wheels, but these are guys from Pennsylvania, Connecticut, New York, and they want their money's worth. They don't want to go home with 5 to 10 pounds of fillets. They won't go. March, beginning of April, they're going to go fishing for unlimited codfish right outside here off of Block Island. They just will not come up to Gloucester. They're spending approximately $400 a person by the time they go through the hotels, the charter boats, the restaurants. And say it's the haddock are not codfish. We live with the limit of codfish because there's always the perception of catching that 50-pounder. Charter boat clients, it's all about perception. It's whether they catch it or not, it's the perception of going. That's what it is. And for seven haddock, which average approximately 5 pounds, they're not going to go. I've already gotten calls, people all concerned, bad news travels fast. The codfish, the haddock, geez, Kev, if they impose a seven fish limit, you're going to have to send us our deposit back. Over the last week, I've had 3 calls and emails. People looking for their money back saying they're just not going to come up. They're going to go right outside of Block Island where the codfish is unlimited. So basically, you'd be putting most of us out of business. We've already made the point about how far off the MRF data is. And, both measures are going to satisfy the law. So if they satisfy the law, please don't put us out of business. Go with the one that's not going to hurt anybody and satisfy the law. If you want, happy to answer any questions. Anybody wants any information about what we do as far as charter boat fishing. All right, well, thank you very much for your time.
Steve, and then the gentleman next to you. Yep.
Good afternoon, council members. My name is Stephen James. I am a National Marine Fisheries Service's Highly Migratory Species Advisory Panel in Washington, D.C., so I get a little bit of taste of what you guys go through. With that said, I'm also the president of the Boston Big Game Fishing Club. I'm the president of the Stellwagen Charter Boat Association. Am I blowing you out noise-wise? Yeah, I'm going to move it forward. Yep, sorry about that. I wanted to wake you up, but not like that. With that said, my intent here is to represent the interest of the 91 charter boat captains and mates that represent our association, the Stellwagen Bank Charter Boat Association. Just last week, we discussed the proposals that have been thrown out by the RAP or thrown into consideration, if you will, the 20-inch retention limit and the daily bag limit. And I just want to point out that our group voted unanimous to ask this council that they not impose a daily bag limit on the haddock, that you impose a 20-inch limit that allows people to continue to fish throughout the day, so that if you land your fish, you can keep on fishing for more fish. The fact of the matter is most of the charter boat operators don't see that many haddock. Most people aren't catching 7, 10, 15 haddock. The reality of it all is that it's quite a restrictive catch. And at the end of the day, we're talking about whether the glass is perceived as half empty or half full. And we ask that you simply allow us to sell these charters as being half full, not half empty. Further, in the early portion of the season, as has been pointed out by Tom DePersia here, previous to my conversation with you, the haddock stock is what we're basically making our living on. We have no opportunity to fish for cod north of the 42 in the early portion of the season. Our only opportunity is to sell people on the notion that they have unlimited access to the haddock fishery. I'll also point out that in some ways, people are concerned about post-release mortality of haddock when we go to that 20-inch limit. I'll simply point to you that anybody who's ever caught a haddock would recognize once they flop off the hook, they make a beeline toward the bottom. They don't roll around on the top like cod. They're not full of air. The post-release mortality, at least from an anecdotal perspective, would seem to be very, very low. In closing, I simply ask that the council members help the charter fleet by adopting a more favorable effort control of the 20-inch size limit. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to elaborate. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Curtis Maxson. I'm a charter boat captain in Green Harbor. Basically, the three gentlemen before me spoke about everything that I want to speak, but I just want to state my name for the fact. And you just mentioned that I'm in favor of the 2-inch size increase. The bag limit will hit us very, very hard. As stated before, the customers want to come up here thinking that there's a chance that they're going to catch that, you know, they have a real, real good day, and maybe they'll catch the mother load of haddock that day. But as previously stated, most guys are going home with 3, maybe 5 fish. The bag limit trips are attractive. I already said that. That's basically it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Anyone else? Don.
Don Swanson, Coastal Conservation Association of New Hampshire. This is the second time now I've sat on a RAP meeting that we were asked to make a decision with no information available for what the consequences would be if we picked any one of these items. If there's a bag limit, can anyone tell me what the bag limit's going to be? I mean, when you're going to make a vote on this motion here, basically you're going with bag limit first, the minimum size. And are we going to find out what a bag limit or size that's acceptable for this 22%?
There were only, I want to say, and maybe Tom will correct me or Terry, sort of back of the envelope calculations by the council on what it might look like. There was no definitive number.
So we're asked to vote on something here that we have no idea how it's going to affect us. And once you close public comment here, whatever comes up, we're not going to be able to comment further.
I'm just the process here is that the council is only going to make a recommendation to NOAA Fisheries as to what actions should be taken. We're not going to vote on the action itself.
When will that take place?
I would have to look to my right and ask that question.
Right. Rip is correct. The way the regulations read is because this is an accountability measure, really accountability measures typically are designed so that there's some sort of automatic adjustment as a result of an overage. And this one is slightly different because of the way the recreational fishery works. And so instead, the responsibility is on the fishery service to change the requirements consistent with the 22% reduction necessary. But we are required by the regulations to get the council's input on how best to do that before we do any of the analyses or before we make a determination about what the best alternatives are. And so that's what we're doing at this point, getting the public and the council's input on what to look at when we try to decide how to respond to this. And then once we do, we will publish the rule in the Federal Register. There may or may not be an opportunity for public comment at that point. I'm not really sure.
And these measures that you picked for this year, they will be in effect for 2013 too?
Right. So the measures will be in effect for 2013 unless we take an action at the end of 2012 based on the information in 2011 to change it. So we will look at it again at the end of the 2011 fishing year to determine whether there was an overage or an underage for that matter.
Right.
Don, if you go back to Amendment 16, and Tom might be able to help me out, there was a table that suggested, I don't know how big of a reduction was needed at the time, but I'll go through the options that were there. It said a minimum size of 21 inches, there'd be no change in bag limit or season. If you went to a 9-fish, there was no change in minimum size or season. At 18 inches, you needed a 7-fish bag limit. So somewhere in there. And Tom, do you recall what reduction we were trying to achieve with that?
Sorry, Frank. No. The one caution I'd make is all of these measures are very specific to what the fishery is catching at the time you design the measure. And I don't know for sure that the catch per angler and the size distribution in 2010 was the same as what it was when we designed the Amendment 16 measures.
And my concern was back then is that the measure we did pick, they took the most, and our payback was way over what we needed to do. And that's my concern today, that we're going to end up paying back a lot more than what we need to. Thank you for letting me talk today.
Thank you. Pat?
Yeah, to the point that Frank raised, I think the reduction was about what we need here, and we are looking at those alternatives as possibilities. So.
Somebody else had their hand up.
My name is Rick Bellavance. I'm president of the Rhode Island Party and Charter Boat Association and a recreational advisory panel member. I made the motion to select a size limit increase to get the 22% reduction, and I'd just like to speak to support that again here and also reiterate the frustration that we had trying to create measures with a small amount of data and no reduction tables, so it was difficult for us to really vet out the different options that we had, and I hope and maybe suggest in the future that we could get a little more information ahead of time. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else? Back to the council, Jim, and then Dave.
Yeah. I have four questions of service. The first question is, have we double-checked these numbers? I know we've looked at, window pane flounder and the scallop fleet and the yellowtail issue in the scallop fleet, and we've found some major errors. So that's my first question. This is the second one is, have we exhausted all of our options? And, I'm not 100% versed on this particular regulation. The third, if this year it looks like we're really the catch rates are much lower than they were in the previous year, can we roll that information in on the adjustment that you have to make? And the fourth point, I guess, I will make in a question is that, we know that the commercial catch was well under what the overage was of the recreational catch, and can you somehow use that in consideration in your deliberations of what your AM has to be? That's it.
So to the first question, of course, we are using the MRF's numbers, we have double-checked our use of those numbers in our calculations. I did actually mean to speak to Patrick's points earlier. I'm looking at the Gulf of Maine haddock numbers for private for the private sector for MRFs for wave two, which is March, April, and they're zero. So I think part of the confusion may be looking at calendar year instead of fishing year. So we're starting by looking at wave three data for 2010 and then go through wave data for wave two data for 2011. In terms of I'm sorry, I lost the second question, but I think I can answer the others. I think that speaks directly to your third point, which was catch rates are down, and we are seeing that. So, for example, Wave 2, 2011 is a lot lower than Wave 2, 2010. We're using Wave 2, 2011. So it's already incorporated into the numbers. And then on the question of the overages, are not being over, sorry, but the underage in the commercial side, unless there's a provision in the FMP to allow that, we don't have the authority to do this. This was, you know, again intended as an AM, and for the most part, AMs are supposed to be automatic kinds of adjustments. And I think that may actually answer your second question as well.
Dave Pierce.
I was going to ask about the accuracy of the data, specifically for the private vessels, because the private vessel catch seems so high, far in excess of the party and charter boat take, that it screams out for a reexamination. I just find it hard to believe that the catch for private vessels can be so high, especially since the fishermen would have to go quite a ways from shore to get those fish in relatively small boats. It doesn't make much sense to me. So. You checked it, but still, could you triple check? it doesn't ring true. Regarding the arguments made by the party and charter boat operators that they have to have some incentive, some motivation to have their patrons come to them because they do come, in many instances, from great distances away, I'm very familiar with that argument because I've had to deal with that argument with the scup fishery in Massachusetts, out of the southern New England area, New Bedford specifically, where I was contacted by patrons from Michigan, from North Carolina, from everywhere, regarding the need to come, well, not the need, but the desire to come to New Bedford to fish for scup on the party and charter boats, and if we indeed did implement a very restricted bag limit, then they wouldn't be able to come. It's not worth their while paying the money to come all the way up those great distances, hotel costs, and the like. So I'm very sympathetic to that particular argument that they do need to have some motivation to get the vessels to come up. I'm also influenced by the fact that the advisory panel did make that recommendation that they prefer the minimum size before the bag. And then, of course, the season would be the last choice. And then I'm influenced by the fact that Gulf of Maine cod, access to Gulf of Maine cod is not the way it used to be for very good reasons. However, it's likely that in the upcoming year, Gulf of Maine cod may be even less available to them through whatever actions we are obliged to take in response to the rather bad preliminary outlook that we're getting as to the status of Gulf of Maine cod. So the ACLs may be affected, and that's definitely going to mean that they'll be more and more dependent upon haddock. So with all that said, I would move to amend the motion, and the amendment would be that NIP should consider the minimum size first and the bag limit second, close season last. So I just reverse the order of the first two options.
Is there a second? Rodney. Discussion. Jim.
I mean, I'm really conflicting here because we've had different recommendations from different groups, you know, and I recognize these gentlemen here giving us a recommendation on this one, but we've also heard recommendations that they wanted to get the other way around. So I don't know which way to turn on this particular motion. I'll go along with Dr. Pierce's recommendation, but it's very difficult to sit here and make that choice when we've had some groups come forward and like the first recommendation. So it's in not knowing the fisheries the way you do, I'll support your motion, but it is a hard one to make this kind of change.
Dave Gaisel.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't support the motion. I wanted to speak to this earlier before we get to this point, but as the reason we lowered the size limit in the first place was because our job is to control mortality. And raising the size limit doesn't control mortality one bit. Most of the haddock that are released die. I have to disagree with the gentleman that came up and said they, you know, they live. They don't. I mean, we studied this. You know, they have very low survivability. Just because a fish swims away doesn't mean it lives. And, you know, so really just increasing the size limit's a feel-good measure. That's all it is. All it means is you're tossing over fish that are dead, 18 to 20-inch fish. That's why we lowered the size limit in the first place. I mean, I think this is a brave new world we live in, and people have got to get used to it, that you can't have unlimited amounts of fish. And I don't think a bag limit's unreasonable. I traveled to Alaska to go fishing, to catch two fish. You know, I think people that really want to fish will fish. And they'll be happy to take home what it is they're allowed to take home. I mean, you don't go to a trout pond and get unlimited trout. You get six or two or four or whatever the limit is on that particular pond. In this case, the pond is the Atlantic Ocean, and now it's going to have a limit on it. And, you know, I really want to remind people of that. We're in a new world here. Everybody's accountable now, and everybody's got to pay. And, you know, none of us like it, but that's the way it is. And pain with a feel-good measure, to me, isn't pain. That's not an accountability measure. One other thing I wanted to say in relation to the numbers is I am suspicious of the numbers. I think the number we were given is that the average recreational angler is catching between 9 and 10 haddock. As somebody who fishes a lot, knows the charter boat industry pretty much inside and out, was in it for 16 years. I don't really buy that number. I have done some investigation in my own area, and I don't think anybody's going to come up here and admit they perjured themselves in the logbooks, so you're not going to get people to come in here and tell you the truth. But the fact is that once this council did Amendment 16 and went to catch history in the commercial fishery, a lot of people started putting down numbers in the logbook that aren't even remotely real because they expect that the recreational fishery is going to go to catch history and they wanted to make sure they had plenty of it. And I think that's part of what's driving these numbers, both cod and haddock. I don't think they're real numbers. But since we don't have observers on charter and party boats, we have no way of verifying them. And like I said, I don't think anybody's going to come up here and admit that they perjured themselves in a logbook and go to jail for 5 years to save their bag limit. So at any rate, I don't support the motion.
Frank Baum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a quick comment. If I get the chance to go to Alaska, I'll go for no fish. But anyway. One other thing, just to make a comment on what Dave said, which wasn't part of my what I wanted to speak on, was I believe the reason we lowered the size limit wasn't a mortality control. It was the wrecks weren't catching their allocation. It was felt that with that they'd be able to catch the allocation. I think it was where that decision came from. But anyway, back to a couple of points. The data that was in question that people mentioned was that Wave 2 data from 2010. And as Pat said, that's fishing year 2009, I believe. So what happened there was a large increase of in-state waters, Massachusetts, private recreational anglers. They went from zero to approximately 54,000 fish. So, and that's where that came from, where party and charter boats for the same wave caught zero in the state water. So I think we're fairly well, haddock are not a state water fish, and that's where a lot of the confusion came from. Looking at the data for this year, the best I can come up with, year to date, we don't have wave four yet. We have three, we have four. I think we don't have four. Four should be out shortly, five will be out mid-December, probably, I would hope, before the service makes a decision on what they're going to do here. This year compared to last year, the landings are about 52-53% of where they were last year. And compared to the year before, they're probably somewhere around 40% or less. If you go to the number of pounds, the best I could do on pounds, it was approximately 658,000 pounds the year before, year to date, and this year is about 336,000. So it is considerably less. I would assume that when the service puts in a restriction, it's going to be something that has to keep you from exceeding the goal for this fishing year as well as next year. So I think it's fairly certain to say that for this fishing year, I don't think anything would have to go in place if we're at approximately 50% of where we are. I would hope that the service takes that into consideration when they look at the following year as well. Because with the exception of that one wave in 2010, which seems to be way out of the ordinary, I think if you take the spikes out of MRFs, I mean, we don't like using MRFs. If you smooth it out, it's a little bit better. But when you pinpoint the data, we all know, you know, what happens if you try to be that specific with it. I will support this motion here. I hope with the understanding that there may not need to be very severe restrictions. I think the reason the RAP, I'm not so sure they're all that opposed to the bag limit. I think it goes back to what Don Swanson said. The biggest opposition was not knowing what it was going to be. I mean, if you support the bag limit up front and it comes back and the average catch is now at 7 fish and you need a, you know, 25% reduction, we're not looking at a 10-fish bag limit if that's what you're going to use up front. And I think that's what the industry was afraid of mostly, that you're going to end up, you know, somewhere along where we are with the fluke fishery, and that you'd be down with a very restrictive bag limit. And that's where they're looking at, you know, the increased size limit. So with that, I would support the motion to go with the increase in size, and hopefully, you know, the service will be looking at the Wave 5 data before they make their decision, and then hope, with any luck, there'll be time for, you know, some public comment. Thank you.
Further comments? Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Dave Pierce's point. We hear a lot about this, particularly at the commission, with the many recreational species of note and the chilling effects of bag limits on ability of party and charters to attract customers. But I think Dave Gafel is right. It's not really a mortality restrictor, and one can only witness what we have done with summer flounder, trying to use large size limits to manage the summer flounder recreational fishery, and we end up with 1 out of 20 fish being legal, extraordinary amounts of discards and so on, and we weren't able to manage it successfully for a long period of time. So I appreciate his point, but I think Dave's is a better statement of where we're at, Dave Gayflett is, and I don't support the motion.
Further comment? Ready for the question? All those in favor of the motion to amend, so indicate. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 in favor. Opposed? Eight opposed, abstention, 1, 2, 3. So that is 6, 8, 3. The motion fails. Now we're on to the main, back on the main motion. Further comment? Call a question. All those in favor, so indicate. 12 opposed. 2 opposed. Abstention. 3. 12, 2, 3. Motion carries. Terry.
I move on behalf of the committee that the council write a letter to the states and the commission asking for their cooperation on coordinating management of fisheries that are managed by the council. This motion passed the committee 10-0.
I go to the public for any comments on this motion. Back to the committee. Dr. Pierce. Terry.
It's a reasonable request, and I only suggest that when the letter is sent to the states that it does not include the threat of preemption. that was provided in a previous letter sent to the states regarding skates, and I won't go there. I went there at the Groundfish Committee meeting, so just a request for cooperation, and I'm sure you will get it, certainly from Massachusetts, unless you threaten preemption.
You mean don't use or else? Terry Stockwell.
I was going to comment much the same from the state of Maine's perspective. This motion came after a discussion by the committee on southern northern winter flounder and a concern about the data and whether or not the state waters landings were exceeding were impacting our ability to better manage the fish, and the concern that this is, you know, if we wrote the states a letter asking them for their help in reducing mortality, it would be better off than doing it a different way.
Tom Dempsey.
I think Terry covered some of that. I just wanted to sort of provide the context for the committee discussion on this, which was, in this case, catalyzed by or brought about by discussion on winter flounder. I think there are a number of other looming issues for which this will be important, and I hope that while respectful and tactful, that we raise some of the specific issues that we see as needing heightened cooperation or heightened attention and collaboration. And obviously, I think some of the issues that were discussed at the committee motion will make their way into the final letter.
Anyone else? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion, so indicate. Unanimous.
Certainly the committee was in the mood requesting the committee to council to write letters, so I move on behalf of the committee that the council send a letter to the Northeast Fisheries Science Center asking for a detailed discussion of the issues surrounding the discard mortality of Atlantic wolf fish.
Committee motion, no second required. Discussion. Oh, excuse me, I'm going to go to the public. Any comments? Back to the committee. Dave Gatham.
Yeah, just quickly to provide people with background that might not have been in groundfish. The reason for this is that we have what you call a fundamental disconnect here, where we're managing wolffish based on the idea that 100% of the ones we release survive, which is based on scientific study. And then on the other side of the coin, when stock assessments are done, they're assuming that 100% of the wolffish die. We can't have it both ways, so we need to have a meeting of the minds here somehow, and that's what's behind this request.
Further committee comments? Call Tom.
I'll just bring up the point that I brought up at the committee meeting, and I'm supportive of the motion and the intent of the letter, but I think it continues to be broader than wolffish. We have a number of stocks that are currently operating under 100% discard mortality that has huge management implications that we know to be flawed, for which scientific information exists that shows that that's simply not the case, and I do think it needs to be a broader discussion. And I'll support this motion.
Further discussion? Call the question. All those in favor? Sixteen. Opposed? Abstention? 16-01. Mr. Stockwell.
The final committee motion, and we touched upon some of this yesterday afternoon about this time. I move on behalf of the committee to recommend that the council form a combined groundfish habitat PDT and a combined AP for the purpose of the omnibus habitat amendment. For the development and completion of this portion of the amendment will be conducted by the full council. The combined PDT and AP would provide technical support and advice to the whole council. This was passed by the committee 5-2-1.
Committee motion, no second required. I'm going to go to the public to get comment. Patrick.
Thank you, Rip. Just want to add the comment in that the way the recreational community, I know, wants to make sure that they have participation on that AP, the way there always seems to be a long-term confusion as to what is the function of the RAP. Formally, it seems that the RAP is a groundfish sub-AP, but the recreational community has obviously vested interest in many of the other subjects and species that are dealt with at the council, and the habitat of this potential combined habitat groundfish AP is going to be brutally important to us. We want to make sure that our activities are completely understood, and I just want to make – it's really important that the recreational community is represented on that AP if and when it gets put together. Thank you.
Judd.
Thank you. I'd just like to briefly say that I urge you to support this motion. I think it's important, and that there's some significant efficiencies to be gained by having crosstalk between those working on habitat areas through the habitat process and those thinking about the future of the groundfish areas. And in addition, I would strongly urge those involved to try to tap into the significant resources you have on the SSC in terms of individuals who are expert on the functioning of closed areas, some of them doing research on them, others been involved in the peer review of the SASE work that's gone on through the Habitat Committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Back to the committee. Jim Odlin.
Yes, I'm going to oppose this motion. Since this motion passed the Groundfish Committee, the Executive Committee met and had an in-depth discussion and some input from staff. And I don't want to speak on behalf of the Executive Committee, but the discussion was that this would not be a very effective use of our staff and our time, and that there was a timeline set up and laid out that we would have the groundfish staff work on some of the analysis that they need to do and then bring the committee, the PDTs together, and that it was discussed that that would be a more effective use of time. So I would oppose this motion and hope that it gets voted down, because this is not going to be an effective way to move this particular issue along.
Chris.
Yes, I had a question about the motion. Does this mean would the motion effectively mean the groundfish PDT couldn't discuss these issues without, except in the context of a joint habitat PDT meeting? Because it's unclear. I think the intent of this motion could be accommodated, but it depends on how you interpret it. If it means that the groundfish committee has to wait to have joint meetings before they discuss the issues, then I think it's problematic.
Dave Gaethel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually going to ask if this motion, or at least part of it, is somewhat irrelevant in light of the priorities discussion and the vote we had already. We did this prior to priorities, so we had no way of knowing how they would come out. Now that we've had that discussion, I don't even know if you might want to rule the motion out of order or something, because it seems to conflict with what we've already voted.
Sally, why don't you make your comment while I look at something?
That's the one that doesn't work. So the intent of this motion was not to limit the groundfish PDT and the habitat PDT to only be working jointly until the time when the habitat amendment is complete. That was not the intent at all. The intent of the motion is to have the two PDTs work together, which My understanding, and I think a lot of people's understanding, is that that's what they plan to do. The purpose of the motion, though, is to make sure that it's clear that the council wants to have advice coming back from the two PDTs, eventually coming with one voice, so that we're not having the Habitat Committee getting advice from its PDT, the Groundfish Committee getting advice from its PDT, and those not matching up. We want it to match up. In looking at this motion and the discussions that have been had at the Executive Committee and earlier in this meeting, I would suggest that maybe getting rid of the second sentence that starts further development and completion. That's the part that we weren't, that I think the Executive Committee, kind of putting my own views on this aside, was not in agreement on. Now, my feeling from talking to some of the staff, talking to council members, is that having the two PDTs function together just for the purpose of the Omnibus Habitat Amendment, and not for everything related to the Omnibus Habitat Amendment, but to be doing their separate things, then coming together before they're giving advice that needs to be given as joint advice, is something that's going to actually help us get the job done. So I would suggest that maybe getting rid of that second sentence might bring this more into line with where the discussion has gone over the last couple of weeks. And I'd have to look at the last sentence. There might need to be some changes there in terms of, the combined PDT and AP would provide technical support and advice to the whole council. There might need to be some changes in that depending on how the discussion goes here, but I still feel pretty strongly that first part is a worthwhile message for the council to be sending to the PDTs as they figure out how best to give advice back to the council or the two committees, depending on how this ends up going forward. Thanks.
Dave Preble and Terry Stockwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't believe that we can make cavalier changes to a committee motion. I don't believe that you can remove that sentence.
No.
And even if you did,
You can through an amendment.
You can? Okay.
Through an amendment.
Through an amendment.
Not
friendly. Through an amendment. If the second sentence is eliminated, then the third sentence makes no sense whatever. The combined PDT and advisory panel would provide technical support and advice to the whole council. What the motion does in effect is it creates a committee of the whole, and I can't think of a better way to take this long running process and make it run twice as long. I see no benefit to this whatever. What needs to happen here, and I think Mark said it earlier with a really nice metaphor. The groundfish needs to analyze the closed areas on groundfish-specific criteria. They were closed on groundfish-specific criteria, and the groundfish committee needs to take that look and then tell us what can be opened through the groundfish process. That would take, and I'll refer this back to Tom because this is his baby, but my understanding is it will take about 4 months for them to complete that. On the habitat side, that is not a wasted 4 months because we have non-groundfish closed area issues that still haven't been wrapped up. We have to finish the coral stuff, which is proving to be a little intractable, but that needs to be finished up. We just finished a two-day PDT meeting for advice on that. We need to complete that coral process. We also need to be producing research areas to monitor the effect of what we do. That is required in the original goals and objectives and has not been addressed yet. I've been pushing on it for a year, and it has not been finished yet. We do not have the expertise on the committee to set up research areas for the purpose of monitoring the effects of our actions, and we have to monitor what we do. The last time we did a habitat action, it turned out to be the wrong thing. Not because anybody intentionally did it wrong or rushed the job, but we did it with no means, no metric for measuring over time the effect of what we did. We can't do that anymore. We have to have a way of measuring the effect of what we did over time. In other words, 5 years down the line, when it's time to look at this again, we have to be able to say, well, we got this part right and that part not so right. And we have to have a metric on that. And that has to be done, and that has to be done by the Habitat Committee. So I would say that that putting them together is premature at this time. I would say that, as Mark pointed out earlier, once the groundfish people analyze the groundfish areas on groundfish criteria, then we will know what the area is that we have to work with. What I think what Mark said was the checkerboard or the chessboard. We don't have that, and that's been the problem. Once that's completed, then the Habitat Amendment through the Habitat Committee can be finished expeditiously. But I see this motion at this point as being a barrier to that completion.
Can we put you down for no on that? I'm just going to make a comment. We still have some miles to ride today, so I'm going to push this discussion along. That was a comment in opposition. Does somebody want to make a comment in favor? Tom Dempsey.
I'll make a quick comment in favor of the intent of this motion, and I think it's what we're dealing with is or the intent of this motion and the discussion of the Groundfish Committee was to avoid, for lack of a better term, structural delays in groups of individuals potentially not working together, and therefore sort of waiting on one another. If that can be done without a specific motion, if that is being done, then perhaps this a formal motion to this purpose isn't needed. But I think the intent is a good one, and that is that we need to continue the momentum and speed up the analysis to get this all done in a coordinated fashion. If it can be done outside of a formal motion, and the various APs or the PDT chairs can call that, can coordinate on their own, then I'm comfortable with that approach as well.
Tom.
All right. In respect to Dave Preble's comment, I think he's right. It's going to take several months, I think, for the Groundfish PDT to figure out exactly where we are. I mean, you have to realize that the Habitat folks have a head start on us of about 11 years. So it's going to take us a month or two to catch up. I'm a little concerned, without weighing in on exactly the language of the motion, I am a little concerned that the implication that the Groundfish PDT and the Habitat PDT are going to wind up speaking with one voice. Because I think it should be recognized early on that it's entirely possible, and I don't know if this is going to happen, but it's entirely possible that when we look at things, we're going to look at it from two very different perspectives, and they may not meet. You know, a lot of people on the Habitat PDT are probably viewing their charge as minimizing the impacts on EFH to the extent practicable. And there may be other groundfish concerns that don't line up well with that. And I don't know that you want us to get, not that we vote on things, but we're like any other group. I don't think you want us to get hamstrung so that the advice you get is so watered down just so we achieve a consensus. Ultimately, the balancing act between, if there are those, the balancing act between those conflicting issues is going to be up to the council. And I would hope that even if we meet together, that we still would be able to say, well, the Habitat PDT says this and the Groundfish PDT says that, and you guys got to sort it out between you. Because I could see that happening on some potential issues.
Thank you. I'm going to take two more comments. The last one was in support. I'll take one more against and one in support, and then we're going to vote on it. Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly, I don't support the motion. A lot of people have spoken to some of the issues with it, micromanaging the PDTs. I think they are capable of dealing with the issues. And the other thing I would just, you know, as far as a combined advisory panel, I would hope as we move towards completion of this amendment that we do have a joint advisory panel similar to the way we constructed it in phase one, which was not every advisory panel member, but a subsection from all of our FMPs. And I participated in that. I thought it was a process that worked well. And this one that's proposed here is just groundfish and habitat. And I think we need to go back to the methodology for the joint AP we used in phase one.
In support. Sally.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just to see if there's a bit of this that has some support, I'm going to, even recognizing the hour, offer a motion to amend, and that would be to eliminate the last two sentences of the motion. So it would be left with simply forming a combined groundfish and habitat PDT and a combined advisory panel for the purpose of the omnibus habitat amendment.
Period. There's a second. Motion fails. Back to the other.
Call the question.
I'm calling the question. I said we were after that. Okay. All those in favor of the motion so indicate. One. Opposed? Fifteen opposed. Abstention? One. 1-15-1. Motion fails. Okay. Mr. Stockwell.
That concludes the Groundfish Committee's motions.
Thank you, and thank staff for all of their work on that. We are going to move right in. Well, I'm going to call on you anyway.
Yeah, but I still have a groundfish issue.
Okay.
Change glasses. I have a motion here that the council requests the regional administrator to utilize her emergency action capabilities to increase the commercial ACL for Gulf of Maine winter flounder, considering the recently completed stock assessment.
Is there a second? Laura? Discussion? Dave?
As you heard under the public comment there yesterday, there appears to be an emerging issue with Gulf of Maine winter flounder becoming a choke stock. I realize the data we have here indicates, I think, only 43% of it's been taken as of November something. But I can attest on a first-hand basis that you can't buy it. People won't sell it. We've had an offer out there for 2 weeks at double the average price, landed price of the fish, and we can't get any. And the fish are showing up in more and more places. I mean, they're a winter flounder right now from 10 fathoms to 90 fathoms at least. And they probably go further, but that's as deep as I fish. And it's reflective of the fact that the stock is probably doing better. And that's what the stock assessment appears to indicate. The ACL is going up next year anyway. I can see some sectors potentially being shut down here well before they harvest most of their fish if we don't resolve this issue.
Go to the public for comment. Vito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to, there's maybe something that looks like is not logical. Some of the sectors are at 30 or 40%. So you'd say we're at 50% of the fishing year. What's the problem? The issue is that a lot of people, I mean, the blackback season really hasn't even started yet in the Gulf of Maine. And there's an assumed discard rate that is applied to all catch that happens in the Gulf of Maine. So in order for these sectors to catch their cod, yellowtail, haddock, pollock, any redfish, all that catch is associated with an assumed discard rate. And 40% of a very low TAC is 138 metric ton. If you spread that out to individual members, people are holding 300 pounds, 500 pounds, 800 pounds, and they still have 50, 60, 80,000 pounds of other quota at a minimum to catch. These are on the very smallest platforms. So there's no way they're going to be able to catch the rest of their fish without having an odd, even if they don't catch a blackback, the assumed discard rate will make it go away. That's why people are holding on to it right now, because they're trying to figure out how the hell they're going to get to the end of the fishing year. So it's a serious crisis right now. And I believe the 2012 TAC out of the new assessment that was completed in June was like 700 and some odd ton, almost a factor of five is the increase, from 138 to 7-something. And the request from industry right now is any relief on that. We don't have a prescribed or requested amount, but a factor of two or three would make a monstrous difference in people being able to finish the fishery this year and catch their quota without running into shutdown. We actually have, I know in our sector alone, we have several members that already know that they're in trouble and are being cautioned that they're going to have to stop fishing very soon if they catch any more fish at all. And we're only at 40% as a sector. And they put an ad out the other day. They're looking for blackback at $2 a pound. They're selling X vessel for about $1.50. And people are willing to pay $2 just so they can go to work to cover bycatch for fish they're not even seeing right now. So it's a serious issue.
Tom? Maggie, Tom, I'll get to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. We would support the motion. I've seen those calls for black bags at $2 a pound. I've been rather shocked that people are willing to pay that, and I haven't seen anybody respond to those offers. You'd think somebody would jump at that, but everybody's holding on to what they have because each individual has such a small amount that they try to protect their ability to continue fishing in the Gulf of Maine for the rest of the year. So anything that could be done to increase this ACL this year would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Tom Neese.
Just real quickly, just to remind people that the 2010 and 2011 quotas for this stock were set when we did not have an assessment. And what the SSC did is they set the ABC at 75% basically of recent catches. So recent catches were somewhat constrained because of the measures in place, including differential days at sea. So that's why, I guess my point is, now we have an assessment, and that's why you see such a drastic difference between the 2011 ABC or ACL and what the 2012 ABC or ACL is. The current ABC and ACL was based on catches over, I think it was the most recent 3 years, which was 05 or 06 to 08 when we did these ABCs. It was not based on any assessment because the assessment was rejected.
Back to the council. Discussion. Dr. Pierce.
I support the motion. This is an excellent example of the impact of a choke species, what it can do to the fishing industry. And it has been testified to by a number of people in the audience, and, of course, I've heard it from a number of different sources myself. But we have a way out of the situation in that we can turn to the assessment advice, the increased amounts of flounder that we've made available through the framework that we have adopted. It seems nonsensical for us to not take action when the numbers will bump up come May 1. I would rather see the industry, sectors in particular, have a far better chance to make it through the fishing year, to not forego a tremendous amount of yield that they otherwise would be able to get out of the Gulf of Maine because of concern about Gulf of Maine winter flounder, concern that now is overblown in light of the fact that we have that the assessment information to use. It's an emergency action. However, it is warranted, especially in light of the findings of the sector workshop that we had, all of the findings of the sector workshop, all the recommendations, the issues that were described. This particular emergency action would be an excellent way to demonstrate that the council did actually listen at the workshop and that we did learn a lesson.
Anyone want to speak in opposition? How did I know? Pat?
Not in opposition, but I have a question and a comment. So I had understood that last week, and this is a question to the state directors, I guess, that there was an action taken at the ASMFC meeting to recommend that, in fact, the quota not be increased the full amount. And I wonder if people could fill me in a little bit more on that action. And then I just want to remind people, for those of you that have not been part of this process before, that I always vote no on emergency actions to preserve the Secretary's authority. So I will be voting no.
Dr. Pierce.
I think Terry, of course, can chime in on this. I believe that, of course, there was a great deal of discussion about the status of the stocks. We agreed to accept the results of the last SOC relative to the findings regarding the status of the stock. And we decided to, ASMFC decided, the board decided to wait until this council deals with the issue and takes whatever action is considered appropriate. That would then trigger action by ASMFC when we meet in February at our winter meeting.
Anyone else? Call the question. All those in favor? Fourteen in favor. Opposed? One. Abstention? Two. So it's 14, 1, and 2. The motion carries. Mr. Gaethel, are we ready to move on to Whiting?
Yes, we are. Unless somebody else has something.
Dr. Pierce.
I'll be very brief, Mr. Chairman. Very brief. Yesterday, I distributed two documents, one being the Comparative Economic Survey and Analyses of Northeast Fisheries Sector 10, an analysis that was done using 2009 data and 2010 days at sea management, sector catch share management. It was an initiative by the Division of Marine Fisheries, primarily by our statistics staff. We did get some assistance from NOAA Fisheries, and it's an analysis that is to assist this council better understand the financial performance of that particular sector between those 2 years. I also distributed a break-even analysis that's been underway for quite a long time now, break-even analysis of the New England groundfish fishery, once again, for fishing years 2009 and 10. I did email you yesterday the description, a brief description of what the break-even analysis is all about. It was an excellent, well-done initiative as far as I'm concerned, a great collaboration between NOAA Fisheries and my agency and SMAST, with Eric Thunberg and Dan Georgiana being the lead economists on this issue, with my statistics program staff also providing a lot of assistance. I'm not going to get into the specifics. All I will do is encourage you to read it, prepare questions, and I hope, Mr. Chairman, that it might be possible at the next Groundfish Committee meeting, for example, for the authors of the reports to provide brief presentations so the specific questions can be asked and answers given, especially regarding the methods that were used to perform these analyses. And by the way, the break-even analysis that we did with NOAA Fisheries did receive a peer review from a number of notable economists that are described in the document itself. I apologize to the audience for not having additional copies for distribution.
That was not possible. However, if it's not already on our website, it will shortly be on our website, so individuals can take a look at it, download it, and read the findings, read the conclusions, and then you can draw your own opinions regarding what these analyses imply for groundfish management and the groundfish industry in New England in recent years. Not specifically under catch share management, pre or after catch share management, but recent years, the financial condition of the groundfish fishery. And I'll also just note that these two reports were submitted by Governor DeVoe Patrick yesterday to Secretary of Commerce John Bryson as part of the governor's renewed initiative. The request for disaster assistance for the Massachusetts fishing industry. Once again, I would refer you to the notice that came out of the governor's office regarding that request. It's best that you reference that. I would not do it justice if I tried to describe exactly what is being requested and the reasons why. So that summarizes where we stand, and I look forward to a near future, more in-depth review and discussion of the work that we have done. To assist this council better understand the recent goings-on, the financial performance of the groundfish industry.
Thank you. Mr. Gaith will bring us home.
Okay. Usually.